This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Now that Election 08 has finally come to an end and the balloons, banners, buttons have nowhere left to go but eBay or to the Ken Rudin collection, it's time to say one last farewell to the Obama-McCain showdown. And if you really want the inside scoop, Newsweek magazine has put together a 7-part in-depth look behind the scenes assembled by a special team of reporters who were granted year-long access to both the McCain and the Obama campaigns on the condition that none of their reporting appears until after Election Day. Well, now that story can be told. It's your chance to ask anything you want to know about the campaigns, from Reverend Wright to Joe the Plumber. If you want the backstory on the Palin pick, debate prep, the money machine, the infighting, and the ground war, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org, and the conversation continues on our webpage. You can go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Now, later on the opinion page, why white gays failed to persuade blacks to vote against California's gay marriage ban. But first, Darren Briscoe covered the Obama campaign for the Newsweek campaign. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Katie Connolly covered the McCain campaign. Good of you to come in, too.
Thank you so much.
They're both with us here in Studio 3A. You can read their work in this week's issue of Newsweek magazine. Katie Connolly, let's start with you. You covered McCain, as I just said. I want to go back to that final town hall meeting in New Hampshire just a week ago, which one of his advisors said his best event in New Hampshire probably ever, but probably also evidence that the candidate was in something of a state of denial.
Yeah, in a way, it was a little bit of a sad event for McCain because the polls really weren't going that well for him. It was fairly evident, I think, to all in the campaign at that stage that they probably weren't going to take it on Tuesday. But New Hampshire has a very special place in John McCain's heart. It was the place that brought his campaigns alive, both in 2000 and in 2008, particularly after his campaign effectively imploded in 2007. You can read about that in the magazine. But if you'll recall, you know, in the fall of 2007, people had sort of written John McCain off. And it was really the people of New Hampshire and his dedication to this town hall style of campaigning that really brought him back. And McCain just loves that style. He loves the give and take with the audience. He loves the questions. He's quite confrontational. He's happy to have a debate. He really invites he kind of invites the conflict to a certain degree. So at Peterborough, it was actually a place that in the 2000 campaign was one of their first events, and they'd actually sent out thousands of flyers, and they had to give away free ice cream to get people to this very first event, well, one of the very first events, and they only ended up getting between 15 and 20 people there, and that was back in 1999. So it was really sort of back to his roots, going back to Peterborough, and he personally really wanted to go there, even though it meant an hour ride from Manchester Airport over to Peterborough. McCain had said to his advisors, look, this is where I want to have it. This is where I want to say goodbye to New Hampshire. So that's what happened.
And at the end of the day, I mean, he leaves the event saying, how are we going to do? How are we going to do in New Hampshire?
Yeah.
And his advisors almost can't look at him.
I'm not sure if they can't look at him, but I think that they had such a great night and he enjoyed himself. They had a huge crowd outside and there was really a buzz on the bus that night. And I think the advisors just didn't want to get into the fact that he looked like he was going to lose the state. And so the idea was, you know, well, let's just not talk about it tonight. Let's just, you know, bask in the glory of what this was. And it was a really great event for them.
Darren Briscoe, let me bring you in. Ever since the last debate, the Obama camp was worried about overconfidence. And last Tuesday night, was there a moment when finally they could start to breathe easier?
Well, you know, I don't know when the campaign as a whole sort of got that feeling. I do know that I saw David Axelrod the day before.
The campaign manager.
Sure. And I saw him on a baseball field in Florida, and I think we were in Sunrise, Florida. And I walked up to him, and Axelrod is famous for being sort of pessimistic and the guy who's always willing to see the sort of the dark side of things. And I walked up to him, and I noticed a couple of things. Number one, he had looked for most of the campaign as if he were walking around with a 40-pound backpack on his shoulders, just sort of weighed down by everything that he was dealing with. And number two, Axelrod has never been that spiffy of a dresser. He's a very sort of regular guy in his dress, typically khakis and kind of hiking boots and maybe a collared shirt. But he was dressed, you know, particularly nicely. I noticed especially that he had some new shoes on, some nice, looked like they were hand-stitched leather shoes. And I walked up to him and said, David, how do you feel? And he said, you know, I'm feeling pretty good here. I'm sniffing the finish line. And for Axelrod, that was, you know, the equivalent of jumping up and down and, you know, doing cartwheels. Mm. I thought it was a pretty revealing moment.
On election night itself, it seemed to be Ohio that swung the deal.
I do think Ohio once, you know, I was told by one of their close friends who was with in a suite at the Hyatt Regency in Chicago, that there was a group of friends and advisors gathered in this room, kind of watching the returns. And the Obamas had gone home for a little while to spend, you know, steal a few moments at home, and they were, you know, just going back and forth with every twist and turn in the results and. Didn't know what was going to happen, obviously. And I think when Ohio came in, this sort of feeling swept through the room, and they thought, you know, finally we've got it. And I think not long after that, Michelle came into the room, and this great cheer just went up in the room, and everyone sort of went up and started hugging her. So I think, you know, they felt then that they had it in the bag, I believe.
We are going to talk more with Darren Briscoe and Katie Connolly, but we want to give you guys the chance to ask your questions, too. Anything you wanted to know about Campaign 08 but were afraid to ask, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And Ken is on the line. Ken calling us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi there. Thank you very much for taking my phone call.
Go ahead, please.
Hey, I have heard reports to the effect that Governor Palin was none too friendly with some of the McCain staff. Also, the shopping spree for the clothes. I wonder if you could just shed a little light on that, because I don't know if some of it is kind of convoluted or if there's any truth to that whatsoever. But we've heard reports to that effect, and I'll just take your comments.
And outraged indignation from Governor Palin's aides. But Katie Connolly?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the days after the election, some of this tenseness between the McCain and Palin campaigns has become a little overblown in the media. I mean, we like a good conflict story, and I think it's probably a little exaggerated. But certainly, towards the end of the campaign, there was some real tensions. Part of it was over the clothing that she had reportedly... Well, aides in the McCain campaign had learned very late in the piece that she'd actually spent a lot more than they thought, and that some of the clothes that she'd bought had been for her husband Todd, some of it for her children, and these are large amounts. I mean, we're talking somewhere between $20,000 and $40,000, and I think that really upset campaign aides at the end of what was a very long, very difficult campaign, to think that this person that had gone out and publicly said that she wasn't going to order clothes anymore and what have you, and they were just brought to her room, that they learned that, you know, up until a week, maybe a bit longer after she'd given that speech, that she was still ordering clothes. So there was certainly some frustrations there, but at the beginning, when she was first joined the ticket, I mean, she was a great addition to the ticket, really energized the base, and she energized McCain. She was a very good advocate for McCain. She was able to tell his story better than he was himself at times. And so I think she was a very, very welcome addition at first. But, you know, here's this woman. She's kind of headstrong. She's known for, like, taking the fight and making it her own. It's hardly surprising that she didn't like being told what to do. It's hardly surprising that this person didn't want... You know, she's a maverick. She's going to do mavericky things. That's her shtick. So
yet you report one item of tension was that Todd Palin, her husband, was apparently calling big Republican donors in the state of Alaska, saying, keep your powder dry till 2012.
Yeah, and that's something that McCain aides heard rumors of sort of late in the week prior to the election, and that really upset them. I think the other thing that upset them, because it was embarrassing, was this phone call from a Canadian radio station.
The prank call pretending to be Nicolas Sarkozy.
And that was just really embarrassing for the campaign, particularly after she'd had a couple of embarrassing performances with Katie Couric and some of the interviews hadn't gone so well. They were very frustrated that her aides would let something like that happen, and the lines of communication clearly were not very good between the Palin and McCain camps for that to even happen.
Now let's get Christian on the line. Christian with us from East Lansing in Michigan.
Hi there. I'm thinking about the Biden pick, and at the time of the pick, it was characterized in the media as conventional, a safe bet, in part because it was endorsed by people like the Clintons. However, Biden didn't really offer some of the things that other vice presidential picks are described as offering: another region of the country, a large number of electoral votes associated with their state. And I was wondering, within the Obama campaign, did people really think of it as a safe, traditional pick for a vice president, or did they think of it as something non-traditional and really just looking for the person that's qualified, or maybe even being willing to take a risk to get for a candidate that they liked?
Darren Briscoe?
Well, I do think one way to look at it is as a somewhat non-conventional pick insofar as typically you hear presidential candidates, or often you hear presidential candidates bandying about names of potential VP picks based on the kinds of things that you mentioned. You know, they'll help them in a certain part of the country. They will, bring in maybe a couple of electoral votes here or there. I think that Obama was much more interested in picking someone who he thought would be able to help him govern. Now, obviously, Biden did bring some particular strengths to the ticket in areas where Obama had been consistently criticized. You know, Biden's been chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has decades of experience in Washington. And so that's an obvious sort of strengthening of an area where Obama, again, had some potential weaknesses. But again, I don't think that he took it. I don't think he made the sort of tactical pick that you often see presidents do, where it's, you know, maybe this guy can help me win a state here. I think it was much more a decision that was much more made in mind with a sort of long term. I'm going to have to run the country. Who will be best? Who do I want next to me to help me run the country?
There is a point at which, though, you say Senator Obama never seriously considered Senator Clinton as a vice presidential running mate. But every time they had the conversation, he would ask again and again, what about Hillary Clinton?
Right. Well, I think what that does is sort of illustrate the committed pragmatism that I think Senator Obama or President-elect Obama has demonstrated throughout the campaign. There was, I think it's pretty plain that there was a lot of animosity between the two camps that developed over the course of the primary season. And there were no small number of people in Obama world who the last thing they wanted to see was Clinton put on the ticket. There was a lot of worry about her own ambition. There was a lot of worry about Bill Clinton and what he might or might not do to hurt an Obama candidacy or an Obama presidency. But, you know, here again, Obama is saying repeatedly, are we sure this is not the right pick? Because, you know, Senator Clinton has a lot of strengths that also would have helped Obama, not just campaigning, but also governing. So he wanted to be sure, despite the bad feelings, despite, you know, everyone think or many people thinking that it was a bad thing, that that they fully consider.
And interestingly, it was also reported in the Newsweek article, the long Newsweek article, that among those who did not want to see Hillary Clinton on the ticket was the McCain campaign. Anyway, we'll have more with reporters Darren Briscoe and Katie Connolly, two of the Newsweek reporters who were, well, didn't report for a whole year because they were reporting on a whole campaign. They couldn't reveal what they'd learned until after the election. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After 2 years, most of us feel like we know every detail of the candidates' lives and the campaign history. But we didn't get to see much during the campaign was who John McCain and Barack Obama really were behind the scenes and what the discussions with them and their top aides were really about. Darren Briscoe and Katie Connolly are two of the Newsweek reporters who spent a year following the candidates in exchange for their remarkable access. They agreed not to publish until after the election. Darren Briscoe covered the Obama campaign. Katie Connolly was with the McCain campaign. To read the entire Newsweek series, you'll find a link on our blog. That's npr.org/blogofthenation. And this is your chance to ask, well, anything you want to know about the campaign, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Let's go to Gary. Gary with us from Memphis in Tennessee.
Thank you, Neil. It's a great show today.
Go ahead. Thanks.
My question is about, not necessarily to your guests today, because I understand they held off their giving their reports till after the campaign was over, but I question the journalistic ethics of reporting on these things going on in the McCain-Palin situation without revealing who the sources are, because for all we know, many of those things reported about Sarah Palin could possibly have been pure slander for all we know. How can we trust what was said? I mean, they claim she didn't know Africa was a continent and not a country. That just sounds so ridiculous.
Well, that's not in the Newsweek story, I don't think, but Katie?
Yeah, certainly there are some things that are reported by Carl Cameron from Fox about her knowledge of the world, which are a little damning, and they are from anonymous sources. But the things in the Newsweek article that are from anonymous sources were confirmed by several sources, and we also went to the Palin campaign for comment, and that was included in our piece as well. So we feel that we have actually gone through the right, jumped the right hoops and all that sort of stuff to actually make sure that what we've reported is accurate.
It just seems like these people who were so undisciplined in the McCain-Palin camps that they couldn't keep it within their own camps without letting it out to the press, these people were so unprofessional at what they do they deserve to be revealed so that they don't ever have another job like this again.
And also, I mean, after the campaign is over, is anonymity still extended to people who call her a whack job?
Well, if these people want careers in the Republican Party and she's going to be a future leader of the Republican Party, I'm sure that there's, you know, people want to keep their heads down. But and I think that the McCain campaign actually, throughout the whole time, was characterized by being a fairly leaky campaign. There was a lot of, and it was a source of frustration, I know, to people like Rick Davis and Steve Schmidt, that there's very little that could go on in that campaign that wasn't on the Politico or the Atlantic blog, you know, within minutes or days, or, you know, it was a characteristically leaky campaign. And I think that that's something that Republicans have to think about in the future when confronting something like the Obama ticket, which was incredibly disciplined and incredibly media savvy in that sense.
Gary, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And let me ask, the New York Times was excoriated by the McCain campaign for reporting that, in fact, Sarah Palin was a last-second pick, that John McCain wanted Joe Lieberman all along, and the reason that Sarah Palin wasn't vetted properly or extensively was, in fact, that she was not chosen until shortly before the Republican convention, after people talked McCain out of selecting Joe Lieberman. Did that story turn out to be right?
That fits exactly with my reporting. I mean, certainly Rick Davis and Steve Schmidt had kept an eye on Sarah Palin for several months. She was someone they had personally identified. But Senator McCain really wanted to have his friend and political ally, Senator Lieberman, on the ticket, even as late, my reporting tells me, as the Wednesday night. She was picked on the Thursday and announced on the Friday. Even as late as the Wednesday night, John McCain hadn't decided and was on the phone with Senator Lieberman that evening. You know, the campaign was having daily meetings about a rollout strategy for if he had decided on Lieberman, how they would reach out to Christian conservatives and social conservatives right up until then. Wednesday. So he was very seriously considered, and I think that they decided, the choice became, could we heal the Republican Party in the 2 short months between the convention and the election, knowing that a lot of the conservative base would react very strongly to a pro-choice candidate like Senator Lieberman?
Let's get Erica on the line. Erica with us from West Hartford in Connecticut.
Hi. I'd like to know if there's one visionary person, producer, who was behind those big Obama events. I'm thinking of the acceptance speech at the Democratic Convention and then the Grant Park acceptance of the presidency of the United States. I just found them amazing. I found them more, you know, better than the Olympics, better than anything I'd seen, but an interesting mix of grandeur and humility at the same time.
Darren?
I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for the call, Erica.
That's a really interesting question, and it's not one that I have an absolute answer to. I don't know that there is one person who was behind those productions. I do know that there was a fair amount, both at the convention and at Grant Park, of sort of tailoring, you know, and tinkering with the presentation so as not to seem, you know, that they weren't overdoing things. And, you know, Senator Obama, ever since his trip to overseas to Europe, had been fighting against this. This character of him that the McCain camp was painting as this, you know, this empty celebrity. And so I do know that they scaled back the somewhat at the convention, some of the things that they had with the columns that you saw. The setup that you saw was not quite as elaborate as the one that they'd originally come up with. But I don't have a name for one person who was behind. I don't think that there was a single person. I think it was more of a collaborative effort.
Let's go to David. David with us from Birmingham in Alabama.
Hi, thank you for taking my phone call. My question is regards to the McCain campaign's decision to shut down its campaign and return to Washington, D.C. after the economy turned south. To what extent was McCain's advisors pushing him to do that? And also, how was he actually dealing with the economy in that time that he's back in Washington?
That would be, I guess, to you, Katie Connolly.
Well, certainly. He was in New York preparing for the debate. You'll recall the debate was that Friday, and he suspended his campaign a couple of days before that when they made that decision. And my reporting tells me that he was certainly advised by key people in his campaign that was the right thing to do. But he also felt like he had bad options. You know, he had Harry Reid saying that he needed to take a position on this bill. They were getting word from friends on Capitol Hill that possibly only 4 House Republicans were going to support the bailout package, and people were calling for his leadership. So he felt that if he stayed aloof from the process, that he would be blamed for its failure. And if he tried to alter a if you tried to offer a different bill, then that would just be killed also by the Democrats, because that would be seen as a political maneuver. So McCain himself didn't see it as a stunt, I believe. I believe that McCain actually thought that this was one his really only good option to go back to D.C. and try and work his connections on Capitol Hill. I think his advisors saw the political opportunity for that and had hoped that it would actually play very well. They'd hoped that they would be able to take credit for this huge leadership move. Obviously, when he got back to Capitol Hill, his help was not wanted. In fact, he became sort of a distraction to the process rather than an aid to the process. I think that surprised Senator McCain, and I think it surprised his advisors. And I think that the Democrats were quite savvy in how they operated during that period to sort of marginalize McCain's involvement and make him look like a bit of a fool for doing it.
And Darren Briscoe, though, they worried initially that they'd been wrong-footed, that they'd been caught by surprise by Senator McCain's move.
By the suspension of his campaign you're
yes.
talking about? Well, I think that there was a little bit of concern about how it would ultimately play out. But my reporting is that, you know, when there'd been this phone call between Senators Obama and McCain earlier that same day where they were trying to work out this joint statement on the economy. And they got off the phone. Senator Obama was waiting for a return call from Senator McCain, and there was a long gap. I think it was about 6 hours where he did not get this. He was waiting for this call back from Senator McCain, and it did not come. And then I think the next thing that they knew, Obama had given a rally in Florida that day, and he was on his way back to the hotel. And the next thing they knew, Senator McCain was announcing the suspension of his campaign. So it definitely caught them by surprise, but there was a lot of skepticism inside the Obama campaign from the very outset that you know, that number one, that Senator McCain, they were skeptical of Senator McCain's, they didn't think that he was actually going to suspend the campaign. And number two, Senator Obama was particularly skeptical.
He didn't cancel the hotel rooms at the
right,
debate site, for
right,
example.
Exactly. Yeah. And Senator Obama was also skeptical that going back to Washington would accomplish anything. This was one of his big concerns. He thought that it would be an intrusion in politics into this huge mess.
Katie?
Yeah, I think one other thing is that it kind of speaks to McCain's character and his sort of impulsive nature. This idea of being the man in the arena is the phrase that he really likes. He wanted to come back to D.C. because he loves being in the thick of the action. He likes to be surrounded by that. And I think it was really sort of a gut instinctive move for him. Well, you know, of course I have to go back. Of course I have to be involved with this. I'm a United States Senator. And he doesn't necessarily always... Somebody described it as a blind spot in his thinking to me, that he doesn't always think about other people's reactions to how he acts. And so although he thought he was doing the right thing, I don't think Senator McCain thought through fully how other people would react to that decision that he had. It just appealed to his romantic streak.
Yes, go ahead, Darren.
I just wanted to add one thing that, you know, this period here is a really crucial one, obviously, for the Obama campaign. And I'm told by his aides that it was one of his most engaged points in the campaign. He's very much a delegator throughout the campaign, is very much comfortable with having people who he designates to take care of this or that. But here was an instance where he was personally working the phone, calling Secretary Paulson, calling leadership on the Hill, and very much sort of taking the reins, because the campaign, you know, this did come out of left field, and there wasn't unanimity about how to approach it or how to deal with it. So, again, he was very involved, but very leery of going to D.C. and making a public spectacle out of it.
An email question from Bob in Mountain View, I think that's in Idaho. Did his grandmother, then Senator Obama's grandmother, know that the polls were not an aberration on the Sunday she last met with him and that he was going to win?
You know, I don't know anything about their meeting other than that they had it. This is obviously, you know, a very personal moment, and the senator was determined to have some private time with his grandmother before she did pass away. So I know nothing about the whatever conversations they did have.
And this email from Laura, how much input, if any, did Michelle Obama have in the strategy of the campaign?
You know, Michelle Obama has, from the outset, had a very sort of well-defined role that expanded a little bit over the course of the campaign, in that she started doing more events once people saw that how good she was with crowds and on the stump. But she has been very much sort of hands-off. She has shown very little interest in being a sort of player in either in the campaign, and I think she's already said in the White House she has no intention of sort of being the commander-in-chief, the second commander-in-chief. She has been almost completely dedicated to raising the girls, to trying to keep their Sasha and Malia, their two daughters, to trying to keep their existence and their lives as close to normal as possible. And again, has not shown a lot of interest in strategizing behind the scenes or that sort of thing.
And one more Obama email here from Grass Valley in California. And Jack, why didn't the Obama campaign agree to the series of town hall meetings proposed by Senator McCain? It seemed like he would have been able to ad lib much better than McCain.
Well, you know, that's debatable. I do think at the time they were offered, this was before the final round of debates between Senators Obama and McCain. And earlier in the race, you know, Obama had been criticized for his debate performances. People thought he was too tentative. He was too professorial. He was umming and awing too much and that sort of thing. Obviously, town halls are a format that have long been considered a strength of Senator McCain's. And the Obama campaign didn't reject the offer out of hand. What they did was kind of counterpropose and say, well, I think the McCain camp had proposed 10
yes.
town halls. And I think the Obama campaign came back and said, well, why don't we do, I think it was 3 or 4 that they suggested, partly because they didn't want to just, accede completely to what McCain was suggesting. You never, I guess as a politician, you never just want to take your opponent's offer because then he can say, well, you have to follow my lead. You don't know what you're doing. But also because, you know, they had a schedule mapped out, a campaign schedule, states they needed to hit, areas that they needed to focus on. And I think they didn't want to just abandon that at the mere suggestion of the McCain campaign. So they counteroffered.
They were also ahead. And if you're ahead, you don't necessarily want to share the stage with your opponent.
Sure. But my point is that I think Senator Obama was genuinely intrigued by the idea. It wasn't that he just said, no way we're doing this. It was, okay, well, this is interesting. Let's see how we can work it out. And they came back. And I think one of the other things that they had proposed was sort of a more Lincoln-Douglas format where they would have longer exchanges mm-hmm. because, you know, Senator Obama's aware that he's not best at the soundbite answers, not best at the sort of quick hit answers.
We're talking with Newsweek reporters Darren Briscoe and Katie Connolly. In exchange for extraordinary access to both campaigns, they agreed not to publish until after the election. Well, you can find some of their results on the newsstands in this week's issue of Newsweek. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Lee, and Lee's with us from Oakland, California.
Hi, it's Leah.
Leah, I apologize.
That's okay. So I'm really interested in sort of a gossipy thing. And is it true that in the McCain camp there was someone crying pretty much every day out of frustration or anger or being embarrassed or humiliated by someone in the upper echelons of the campaign?
No, I think that was Katie. No, I'm not.
Yeah, I cried a lot. No.
Katie Connolly?
Actually, no. I think it was a happier place to work than what is currently being said. Sure, I think there was one event that caused a lot of problems, and that was when right before Senator Obama did his overseas trip, the McCain campaign had orchestrated this counterattack, saying that it was a political opportunistic move. And Senator McCain himself had signed off on this attack, and they'd put Jill Hazelbaker, the communications director, on TV that morning. Another advisor had organized some people in Capitol Hill to give a statement. They'd put out a policy memo. So they had this coordinated attack. You know, Obama's doing this for political reasons. And then McCain comes out and says, oh, no, I'm glad he's going to Iraq. You know, I'm glad he's doing this. I think he should have gone to Iraq. Don't worry about Jill. I'll speak to her. And that was that caused some tears, and that caused some people to not come to work the following day. And that weekend, I believe Steve Schmidt had a long conversation with McCain that said, you know what, if you want to do these sort of things, sure, but if you want to be president of the United States, then you have to stick to the plan.
Leah, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
In a way, any political observer could have said last January 1st, before the Iowa caucuses, that whoever gets the Democratic nomination, given the situation around the country, the unpopularity of the president, the war, even before the economic crisis, more than likely the Democrats going to win, more than likely any Republican who gets the nomination is going to lose. Greater forces than the campaigns were at large in the country. In the end of the day, briefly, what do you think we learned as the result of the process that might have been able to have been predicted all those months ago? Darren?
Well, I guess the simple lesson that I think is learned is that probably organization, you know, beats disorganization in a political campaign, and strategy beats tactics, because I think that's one of the main differences you saw in the campaigns was a very strategic one in Obama's case and a very tactical one in McCain's case. You know, the politics were what they were going into the race, obviously, but, you know, you can't, it's easy now, I think, to underestimate the challenges that Obama faced at the outset, not just of the campaign against Hillary Clinton, but even against McCain, who was, if you recall, you know, his stature as sort of an American hero, that sort of thing is, and as a, you know, unambiguous American, mm-hmm. it was a big advantage against someone like Obama, where there were questions being raised.
And Katie Connolly?
Well, I think one of the interesting things was you had this incredibly prolonged campaign on the Democratic side, which we forget, between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama.
We don't forget.
But sort of it pales in contrast now. So those two were sort of tearing each other apart for months and months and months, while McCain was going around the country doing all sorts of speeches and what have you and just struggling to get any sort of real recognition for what he was doing. So I think there was a whole point. Someone said to me once, campaigns are won and lost between March and June. And I think that perhaps, you know, perhaps Senator McCain just fell off the radar in that period.
Thank you both very much. Appreciate your time. Great article. This is Darren Briscoe and Katie Connolly of Newsweek magazine. And when we come back, we're going to be hearing an argument that California's white gay community took many black votes for granted and lost Prop 8. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now time for the opinion page. The campaign against California's Proposition 8 worked to equate gay marriage with civil rights. Based on the result, the argument failed. Voters approved the constitutional amendment that defines marriage as between a man and a woman, and black voters who turned out in large numbers to elect an African-American president of the United States supported the gay marriage ban in California by 2-1. Jasmine Kanick says she is a perfect example of why. In an op-ed in Saturday's Los Angeles Times, she wrote, "I am black. I am a political activist who cares deeply about social justice issues. I am a lesbian. But even I was not inspired to encourage black people to vote against the proposition. The white gay community never reached out to black voters," she argued, and, quote, "many black gays just haven't been convinced that this movement is about anything more than the white gays who fund it." Jasmine Kanick is a journalist and a regular contributor to NPR's News and Notes. We have a link to her op-ed, "No on AIDS White Bias," at npr.org/talk. And she joins us now from the studios at NPR West. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you. Hi.
And you wrote, "At a time when blacks are still more likely than whites to be pulled over for no reason, more likely to be unemployed than whites, more likely to live at or below the poverty line, I was too busy trying to get black people registered to vote, period. I wasn't about to focus my attention on what couldn't help but feel like a secondary issue." And that points to a problem, you argue, in the campaign led by primarily by white gays in California.
Absolutely. I mean, but this has been the story of that whole movement. And, you know, for people in my position who, you know, happen to be black and or gay, you know, it presents a problem because obviously I'm disappointed with the numbers of African Americans who turned out and supported Proposition 8. Obviously, that is a problem for me as well. But I think what really bothered me the most was that after the election, all of the anger turned towards African Americans from the gay community, as if single-handedly African American voters were the reason why Proposition 8 passed. And I just felt it was time that we start to have an honest conversation about how this campaign was run. And it was, quite frankly, it was a poorly run campaign based on an outdated civil rights method that they were trying to use. And to the extent that, you know, anyone's listening who's a part of, you know, the planning of these movements, maybe next time, you know, they sit down at the table, they'll include more people of color, more African American gays and lesbians, as well as Latinos and Asians, because we come out of these communities, we know what works and we know what doesn't work.
And one thing that didn't work, you argue, was the argument that the case for gay marriage was equivalent to the case for civil rights.
Yeah, that just doesn't go over too well in the African-American community. And there are many reasons for that. I mean, it doesn't even set right too much with me. While I can obviously see the similarities, they are not the exact same. And you have to remember, when you think about the movement for marriage for gays and lesbians, the face of that movement has always been white gays and lesbians. So when you have that image telling you that, you know, your struggle for equality, your struggle, you know, to be able to use any restroom, go to schools, all of that, you know, when you have that person telling you that, it doesn't go over too well. And I don't think they really understand that, because at the end of the day, you know, yes, they're gay and lesbian, and yes, you know, there's an issue of inequality as it relates to marriage. But if it were 1955, they would still be able to go into any restroom. They'd still be able to go whatever school they wanted to. And we weren't. And even me as a lesbian, I would not have been able to. So I think we need to move away from that argument, at least where it relates to African Americans, because it's clear that it does not work.
We want to invite our listeners to join the conversation. How does the issue of race and gay marriage play out where you live? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. You can also email us, talk@npr.org. And Jasmine Kanick, I did want to ask you, there were similar measures on the ballot this year in Arizona and Florida, where the proposals for gay marriage or bans on gay marriage also were approved by voters. And it's been on the ballot in dozens of other states over the past 4 years, really. Do you think that this, you're writing specifically about California, but do you think the same kind of the same kind of mechanics are working elsewhere?
Look, if in Florida and Arizona, if the folks running those campaigns run the same campaign that they ran in California, then absolutely. I can tell you that on Election Day, I was in the Jordan Down Projects in Watts to get out the vote. And I'm debating the merits of Proposition 8 in the projects. It wasn't a subject that a conversation that I brought up. It was a conversation that actually came to me while I was out there. And you know what that said to me? It said to me that the proponents of Proposition 8 managed to get their message all the way into the most economically depressed parts of the African-American community. However, no one from the No on 8 campaign had done the same. Even in my own neighborhood, I received dozens of mailers from the Yes on 8 campaign. I never received one mailer from the No on 8 campaign.
And just to people get confused, Yes on 8 was for the gay marriage ban and No was opposed
right.
to
it
the
It was gay one of those yes
ban.
Means no.
Yes, right.
Yes.
Which also didn't help things either. But there's plenty right. of television advertisement. You're just saying the ground war that we talk about, which was so effective in Senator Obama's campaign,
right.
Was not waged, at least in African-American communities. And you also on the civil rights issue said a lot of that for African Americans is associated with the church, and to the degree that the No on 8 campaign was seen as anti-church, it was not going to be effective.
As it relates to those African Americans who are deeply religious, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is, you know, again, it's hard. It's especially hard, again, for people in my position who seem to be caught in the middle of this. And you know, it is very true that the civil rights movement, our civil rights movement, is connected to the church, whether we like it or not, it is. And so to that extent, if you're going to continue to make this argument and push this case for marriage while asking African Americans to separate the issue from church, it's going to be a losing argument. And again, that's when I say it's time to go back to the drawing board. But when you go back to the drawing board, you bring some other people with you who come out of the communities that you need to get into or that you need to learn to work with, because it doesn't work when you're looking on the outside, from the outside in. And that is, I guess, my biggest problem I have with the gay community is that there is very little collaboration between them and African-American gays and lesbians. You know, oftentimes they just try to, you know, it's almost like they just expect Black people to do this because of that. And we cannot operate on that method. We cannot operate on that kind of thinking, or else you get what happened on November 4th.
Are you suggesting that African-American gays and lesbians are closely associated with the church? That's not my impression.
Look, we came out of the Black church, okay? And many of us are still there. So, you know, I personally don't go to church, but I know plenty of African-American gays and lesbians who still go to Black churches, okay? Again, we come out of these communities. I always tell people that I don't live in West Hollywood. I live in the hood. And that's very true for me. I live as a lesbian where you could find the majority of Black people in Los Angeles. Why? Because I am still an African-American, and that's where I feel most comfortable at. And I know that's pretty much true for other African-American gays and lesbians. They tend to live where you find black people. You know, you won't find us so much, you know, in overwhelming numbers in West Hollywood or in the Castro District and DuPont Circle and all the, those other sort of trendy gay neighborhoods. Why? Because we're still dealing with the same issues that affect African-Americans, period, whether it's driving while black, whether it's unemployment, whether it's, you know, affordable housing, last to be hired, first to be fired. We still have to deal with all of those other issues, which is, again, one of the reasons why, you know, I don't think that there was a huge movement on our behalf around the whole Proposition 8. Now, I'm not saying that there weren't black gays and lesbians out there campaigning for Prop 8, because there were. But to the overwhelming numbers as their white counterparts, absolutely not. Many of us were out there just trying to get black people to be registered to vote for anything, period. And then the last point I'll make, which I think is really, it's really crucial, is that, you know, on the eve of this most important election, and this election was important for African Americans as well as gays and lesbians, you have, you know, a West Hollywood man put a noose around a Sarah Palin effigy that then becomes a national story. And it angers African Americans. I know, right here in Los Angeles. I mean, it really, really, really upset us. And I was trying to get the community to understand these are the things that don't bode well in the African American community. I don't like Sarah. I didn't like Sarah Palin. But if I were going to do a demonstration, a noose would have never came into my psyche to use, because I understand what a noose symbolizes. And so it's those kind of things that happen that tend to, you know, keep our community separated.
On the opinion page this week, Jasmine Kanick, journalist and commentator, regular contributor to NPR's News and Notes, wrote an op-ed in Saturday's Los Angeles Times, No on 8 White Bias. You can find a link to her op-ed at our website, npr.org/blog of the nation. You can join the conversation by giving us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email from Peter in Cary, North Carolina. I object to the tone of this question, white gay votes took black votes for granted. The real question is how a marginalized community can turn around and support the marginalization of another minority. Why shouldn't gays take for granted that blacks who suffered under laws prohibiting interracial marriage would vote against bigotry? They claim that it's a religious issue, but the same Bible was used to justify slavery.
Yeah, again, you know, we need to go back to the drawing board. I've heard it all. I mean, I've even said it all. And at times I had to go back and rethink how I dealt with this issue within the African-American community. I mean, I don't know if people understand the importance of this past election for African-Americans. We came out in numbers. We spent an entire year, 2 years, registering black voters. That was our number one priority. I'm not saying that any one struggle is worse than the other one, but what I am saying is that there's a clear misunderstanding of what our priorities were as African Americans. And to the extent, again, that people are open enough to think about this, you cannot dictate to another community what their priorities are, especially if you don't come out of that community and you haven't done anything to work with that community. And you cannot take that community's votes for granted either. It just doesn't work.
Let's get Kalima on the line. Kalima is calling us from Baltimore in Maryland.
Hi. Yes, I am an African-American lesbian. I work on gay rights issues, and I also work in public health issues. And frankly, gay marriage is an issue that seems to be owned by the white gay movement. The issues I see in my everyday work relate to HIV and AIDS and violence and homelessness, issues that are not necessarily just impacting gay African-Americans, but all African-Americans. And until the gay rights movement takes these issues into consideration, things like Proposition 8 are going to always be accepted, and they're always going to pass.
I absolutely agree. I was having a discussion about that, and someone brought up Maslow's hierarchy pyramid and sort of the things that, you know, to the extent of, you know, what we need to survive. Los Angeles, black people make up the majority of the homeless. okay? In Los Angeles, we have so many issues as it relates to African Americans. And these issues don't just impact heterosexual African Americans. They impact all of us. But in terms of community collaborating, you know, you don't see the gay community trying to work with the Black community to say, hey, you know, I understand this issue is relevant to your community, and it's relevant to our community too, because, you know, our community also includes Black gays and lesbians. So maybe we can work together on registering Black voters, because that way, if they're registered, maybe they can vote no on Prop 8. But if they're not registered, they can't vote anything on Prop 8. There was no cohesiveness. There was no collaboration in that area. And there never has been. And as long as it continues to be that way, again, you're going to always have this separation. You cannot just come into the Black community during election season and then only to the communities that you've gentrified, because you're not coming to Compton, you won't come to Watts, you won't come to South Los Angeles, and then just expect the Black vote to turn out in your favor.
Kalima, thanks very much for the call.
No problem. Preach, girl.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Let's see if we get Michael on the line. Michael's calling us from Flagstaff in Arizona.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it.
Go ahead, please.
I disagree with what she's saying here. I'm a Hispanic, and I'm really disappointed in my own community for doing the same thing. I'm in Arizona. We had a similar bill here that did not get passed, and, you know, we have a majority Hispanic rule. I feel that religious zealots have gotten away, and I feel that it's hypocritical to say that this is not similar to the civil rights movement of Cesar Chavez or Martin Luther King, you know, because you just don't really know for sure how they were affected, because they were always in the closet. They were always in hiding because they were afraid of getting killed and hurt themselves. You tell the gay man or the lesbian who got whose partner got killed that there's no relation to civil rights for being gay. They got beat down and killed for being gay. And there's no relation there. I just don't see that.
Well, okay, to the extent that maybe you didn't understand what it was that I said, I'll repeat myself. I'm also disappointed in Black people. I started off this conversation by saying that, but that's a different conversation that, you know, Black folks will have amongst Black folks. But again, you have to look at what the term civil rights means for different people. And when you talk about civil rights in the African American community, it is inextricably connected to the Black church. And as long as that is, and I assume that'll be till the end of time, there's always going to be this issue around religion. And what the gay community or the gay strategists who put these campaigns together don't realize is that you're not going to be able to separate it. It's going to be a losing battle every time. And so to that extent, we have to come back to the drawing board and figure out another strategy, something else that works with African Americans that they can relate to better, that will help them get it. I tell people all the time, if you're so religious and you think I'm going to hell, then let me go. God doesn't need your help, all right? Stopping me from getting married is not going to, you know, make me straight all of a sudden. So, I mean, what I'm saying is that we have to think about the language that we're using with the different communities that we're trying to reach.
Michael, thanks very much for the call. I know you probably still disagree, but we're going to have to stop it here. Appreciate it.
All right, well, thank you.
Bye-bye. And Jasmine Kanick, we appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
Jasmine Kanick, journalist and commentator, regular contributor to NPR's News and Notes. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.